Lecture number 6, I believe. Yes, lecture number 6. Christmas Seminar, next step, illumination. I am spiritually illumined. Lecture 6, entitled Secrets of Amazement. Secrets of Amazement. You know, we all think that we're pretty smart. We think that we've got everything pretty well in order, everything pretty well in hand. And we do. But we have no idea how the world operates itself, how the world is run. We think that our minds are what guide our thinking. We think our minds are what control our bodies and our world. We think that everything we do is categorical. It follows a given period, a given path, a given program. And in large measure it does. But in large measure it does not. And this is the amazement that we can have if we allow ourselves. What are some of these secrets of amazement? I have just been looking through some interesting books on interesting things that happen. And for instance, regardless, fact or fiction, we actually still know surprisingly little about some of the miracles that are constantly taking place within our bodies, our minds, the world around us, and the universe beyond. We just don't know. There are people that have been experimented with by scientific community in a very careful, controlled circumstance, and they have been found to be able to see without their eyes. Now, you say that shouldn't be too hard for us to believe, because we can see without our eyes when we visualize that we're going to visit Luna, your dog, at the kennel. You can visualize the kennel, you can see it, you can be aware of it, and you can see your apartment, and you can know it. And you can see your cat, and you can see the cat, Jocelyn, just having a great time, and she's just a wonderful cat, and everybody loves her, and she's just having a ball. And you can see her doing that. And you can see your grandchildren just having a wonderful time. They're all where?
Somewhere. Skiing.
They're all where? In bed or skiing?
All skiing.
Now, what story would you ever tell about your grandchildren? Would you ever tell anybody that your grandchildren were not well?
No.
Because if you tell them that, then other people would be feeling that, and if they hadn't figured it out for themselves, they would soon be not feeling well. Mm-hmm. Okay. These experiments were done, and these people saw without their eyes. They saw with their elbow. They would put their elbow around, and one girl saw with her nose. And she would see her nose, and the experimenter put a pencil near her nose, and she said, "What are you trying to do, make me go blind?" You know, to touch her seeing effect. And it was quite amazing. And other people, we know of many of them, have driven through city streets, crowded with traffic, without having a blindfold, definitely over their head, really a solid blindfold that could not see a thing, and they drove perfectly. They knew every car that was there, every stoplight that was going on, brake light of any car that was made out. They knew it, and they could see it perfectly. Scientists say that memory is everywhere and nowhere in particular. We don't have to see to have a memory. We can feel memory, we can know memory, and we can have memory at the tip of our finger. We can have memory at our toe or at our hair. We can have memory anywhere, and it doesn't have to be in a specific place. And this is something of the strangeness that goes on in the world around us. Now, they have a story here about these mice, and they say, use your brains. And contrary to popular belief, the human brain does not necessarily lose its power through age. Constant mental activity will keep the brain young. That is what Professor Marion Diamond of the University of California says after years of research on the development of the human brain. She bases her findings on the behavior of young rats. How about that? Of young rats, instead of keeping the rats on their own in empty cages, she and her fellow researchers gave them a stimulating environment, the company of other rats, plenty of playthings, such as wheels and ladders, in fact, everything that would make them use their brains. Professor Diamond found that this stimulation changed the chemistry and structure of the cortex, the brain's thin outer layer of nerve cells. Every part of each nerve cell enlarged, and the number of support cells attached to them increased. As a result, the brain of these rats became more active, and the creatures were better able to cope with the number of different tasks the researchers set before them. The team of researchers then experimented with elderly rats, aged 766 days. In terms of a rat's potential lifespan, this is the equivalent of a human age of 76 years. When stimulated, even these old rats showed a thickening of the cortex. What do these experiments imply for the human brain? Professor Diamond interviewed a number of active people who were over 88 years old. She says, I found that the people who use their brains don't lose them. It was that simple. And of course, that's true for us too. If we use it, we don't lose it. Now, what does it really take to be clever? And treating a mathematics student at the University of Sheffield, England, for a minor ailment, the campus doctor noticed that the young man's head was slightly larger than average, 24.5 inches in circumference. The doctor knew that one of the university's neurologists, Professor John Lorber, would be interested and sent the student to see him. The student had an IQ of 126, well above average, and was expected to earn the equivalent of a summa cum laude in his studies. What astounded the professor was that the man's head revealed virtually no brain at all. A damning effect. The student suffered from hydrocephalitis and literally water in the head. The liquid is, in fact, cerebral spinal fluid, which is produced in cavities in the inner part of the brain and normally circulates within and around the brain and the spinal cord and finally enters the bloodstream. But the this fluid gets dammed up inside the brain. The usual effect of this are malformation of the brain hemispheres, enlargement of the head, and should the victim survive beyond the first few months of childhood, severe mental retardation. But this bright student had lived a perfectly normal life, even though he had only a fraction of an inch of cerebral tissue stretched around the inside of his cranium instead of the usual 1¾ inches of depth. Lauber has now identified several hundred others whose cerebral hemispheres were virtually non-existent. Some whom he describes as living with no detectable brain and yet having a score of 120 IQ and better. He does not know why this is so, since it is the hemispheres of the brain that do most of its work. These people, he suggests, other less developed parts of the brain may take over. On the other hand, it may be that a normal brain requires only a fraction of its full capacity. Whatever the reason, it is apparent that a small brain is no bar to having a fine mind. Interesting. You see, we come up with these concepts that we believe have to be fulfilled, that they have to be satisfied. We say, this is what the perfect man is. This is what the perfect brain is. And we know some of our favorite statements. Einstein was kicked out of school, and he became one of the greatest scientists in the world. And Edison was kicked out of school because he couldn't learn. He didn't have the capacity to learn like the other students, and he became one of the greatest inventors that the world has ever known. And many other people have had equal experiences. So it's not how well you fit in with the pattern of the world around you, but how well you fit in with the pattern within yourself of your own inward ability. what is the secret of amazements? What these are fantastic experiences when you stop and think about it, but this is what the brain is all about. This is what we are all about. And this is where we are going in our consciousness. Now, I worked with Thelma Moss at the UCLA in Los Angeles, and we did work with Carillion photography on our hands, showing the radiation of the energy from our hands and so forth, which is quite beautiful and quite significant. And we also worked with some blind girl. She came into the room and had her seeing eye dog, and she went up to the front of the room and sat at a desk, and then she was given paper to look at, and she was asked what color the paper was. And she was able to tell the colors of all the papers just by touching it. Now, the papers had no way of giving off radiation or light or energy, but she knew, because she could see with an eye that we cannot interpret. Now, we're so ready to say, well, this is done by the heat, this is done by the radiations of the temperature of the ink on the paper, and, well, you gotta be quite spectacular to read that with your fingertips, you know? And I doubt that it's reading that. I think it's the same way that the pyramids were built. They were built with consciousness. Mm-hmm. So she was able to see through consciousness. Mm-hmm. She was able to see through an eye that was not evident to us. And like some of the children were seeing with their elbows and with their nose. Strange things. Now, there's more to vision than the eye. Everyone knows how important eyes are. A direct extension of the brain, they are among our most sensitive and vulnerable organs. Everyday speech reflects the preeminence of vision among the five senses. I see is synonymous with I understand. Surprisingly enough, the human eye is in fact a kind of radio receiver. Visible light in the form of electromagnetic radiation, which includes low frequency radio waves at one end of its spectrum and short, extremely high frequency X-ray and gamma rays at the other end. Light falls between these two extremes. The eye can detect electromagnetic cells signals with wavelengths of far less than a thousandth of a millimeter. The frequency lie between 0.00072 millimeters, the wavelength of red light, and 0.00038 millimeter, the wave of violet light. And between all these lie the spectrum of the colors of the rainbow. Picking up these minute vibrations are no less than 125 million light-sensitive cells in each eye. The nerve cells are divided into two separate systems. A set of cones that detect color and operate in good light, and a set of rods that see only monochromatically and come into play in poor light. The momentary blindness we experience when moving from darkness to bright light, or vice versa, lasts for a time, but the time it takes the eye to switch from one system to the other. The rods tend to be scattered around the edges of the retina, away from the center, which is why it is easier to see things in the dark when one is not looking directly at them. These receptors are astonishingly sensitive. In total darkness, the human eye can detect the light of a solitary candle positioned 5 miles away. In dealing with the information they receive, the nerve cells in the eye perform about 10 billions of calculations per second. During the same time, the same second, the eyeballs have moved around in their sockets about 100 times. Thus, this eye tremor does not blur vision, but actually improves our ability to see very fine detail. It allows the brain to process light that falls on the eye at different angles. The fact that visual information reaches the eye is no guarantee that someone can see it. People born with clouded corneas who have no visual experience at all have been utterly confused by what they saw after surgery had restored their sight. Even The simplest geometric diagrams held no apparent pattern for them, and they had to learn to make sense of it all anew, the visible world they had just entered into. Medical scientists and psychologists agree that it is the brain, not the eye, that integrates the seemingly disparate data that the eye detects. Experiments with cats show that the brain cells that are activated by ventricle lines are quite different from those activated by horizontal lines, which are in turn different from those that react to diagonals, that'd be vertical lines. Therefore, when we see a triangle, the brain performs two separate functions. It automatically recognizes the separate elements of the triangle, and then it integrates these elements so that we can see the triangle as a whole. But apparently the second function, organizing information into a coherent picture, is something that the brain has to learn from experiment and experience. Precisely how it does that remains one of the great mysteries of science. Interesting. So, we have a lot more here, and if you're interested, you're welcome to read some of that. But then the matter of taste. For some people, eating is one of the great sensual pleasures of life. The taste of a meal is one of those reasons we like or dislike our food. Yet the actual mechanics of taste are still not completely understood. Taste is detected by minute, barrel-shaped tasted buds, about 9,000 of them, located on the upper surface of the tongue. There are also a few taste buds in the throat and on the soft palate at the back of one's mouth. The tip of each taste bud carries a group of 15 to 20 taste receptors. Cells linked to nerve fibers that carry the taste impulses to the brain. Taste receptors have a short life. They are completely renewed every 7 days or so. As we grow older, the number of taste buds decreases. Thus, older people are less receptive to taste than children, a fact that may explain why some children dislike strong-tasting spicy foods. Discerning detectors. The taste buds can detect only four basic tastes: sweet, sour, or acid, salt, and bitter. Different areas of the tongue respond to these different taste senses. The tip is sensitive to sweet things, the side to sour, the tip and the sides to salty, and the back of the tongue to bitter. Some substances, therefore, seem to produce different flavors depending upon which part of the tongue they stimulate. For instance, on the tip of the tongue, saccharin tastes sweet. Further back, it tastes bitter. The actual experience of taste, or more accurately, of flavor, is more complex. It involves not only the sense of taste, but also other senses and qualities. These include the sense of smell, sight, temperature, and texture of food. Smell is particularly important. Everyone who has eaten food while suffering from a heavy cold knows only too well how the flavor of the food may be impaired. Indeed, although a cold is said to destroy the taste of the food, what it actually destroys is its smell. Acting on impulse. Scientists still do not completely understand the taste process, but it would seem that taste is probably the result of a mild chemical reaction. The molecules of the food being tasted from a bond with the molecules on the surface of the taste will change the taste cell. This excites the nerve fiber, which in turn gives rise to a nerve impulse. The central nervous system relays that sensation to the brain, which identifies the taste and associates it with a particular food. Whenever the process, one thing is certain. Without our ability to taste, food would cease to be the pleasure that it is. And in our final consideration of the number of things here, a dream come true. Putting the dream world to practical use. Psychologists at St. Thomas's Hospital in London have developed a special talent that most people would envy. He can control the contents of his dream. In them, he creates magical fantasies. Snapping his fingers, he produced a flame like a cigarette lighter. He can soar through the air or pass a knife harmlessly through his wrists. Even more remarkably, he sets a specific task to perform while dreaming, and he accomplishes them. He has counted objects, moved his arms and eyes, and spoken aloud in his dreams, just as he has predicted he would, while electrical sensors have confirmed that he is in the dream state, really in the dream state. Now, these things are fascinating, and these things are something that anyone can do. That his achievements seem very lucid and very fantastic, and they can manipulate the dream world. Although many people have this experience, psychologists and philosophers have dismissed it as fantasy or mistake. But this doctor has found that he has really experienced it, and many others have done likewise. And they have pointed out that by researching their dreams and paying attention to it and being aware of it, they can have many beautiful and fantastic experiences about it. So, secrets of amazement. Our body, our life, our world, our experience is a secret of amazement. Just the matter of a sperm and an egg getting together and creating a human body with all the likenesses of the parents and the parents' parents and going back generations, that these chromosomes and DNA and so forth are following through is utterly amazing. It's an amazing thing. And if we want to think about it, it's even more amazing, because it's not just a matter of the construction of the form. It's giving the form life. It's giving the form taste, touch, the five senses. It's giving the form all of these things. And we have this talent, this ability at our fingertips. We can do this to our heart's desire, to our heart's content, and have a good time doing it, and we are not doing anything bad. Modern-day science feels that to fool around with the human body is to fool around with something very sacred. Well, that's quite true. To fool around with an animal's body is equally sacred. To fool around with an ant or a rat or a frog or a salamander is equally sacred. Why should we say that just because we can understand the human, that we say just the human is sacred? Now, who understands a salamander? Another salamander. And do they have a community of salamanders? Do they? You probably heard of The Animal World. That's a book that was put out a short time ago. And in the book, the animals were ruling the world, and the humans were their pets, you know, or slaves, or whatever they wanted to make them. And the animals, of course, because the book was written by a human being, had all of the human attributes, and the human beings had all of the animal attributes. All of the animal attributes of living in the consciousness of having fun and enjoying life and not feeling any responsibility unless it was placed upon them and trained into them, which is a proper and normal thing to do. Now, where do we stand in this amazing attitude, this amazing experience of all life? Here we are saying that I enter my spiritual reality, I enter my spiritual life, I enter my spiritual illumination, and what does that mean? What does that mean when we enter our spiritual illumination? Does that mean that we can levitate and teleport? That we can fly without wings or without anything? Does that mean that we do or do not need food? There recently was a man who was 126 years old. He was proven of record because his name and age at 6 years old was inscribed in the first census taken in Japan in 1864 or something like that. And the man was amazing, you know, quite amazing. And this was in 1984 or 94 that this was written. And so it's 120 years old. And what did he ascribe his long life to? Well, he ascribed it to drinking his sake every day. And he stopped smoking when he was 120 years old. He just had no more interest in it. He ate basically the Japanese product of rice and vegetables and things like that from his... He lived on a separate island with his community, and they were sort of isolated from a lot of other activity, and so his life was quite remarkable. But today, in Japan, they have found that people are going to live another 20 years longer than the birth rate that they gave them before, the death rate. And their previous death rate in Japan was at the age of 75, average. And now, it's 95. 95 years is the average lifespan of these people in Japan. Now, that's quite good, wouldn't you say? Mm-hmm. Now, how many of us are going to live to that age or longer? What limitation do we have on how long we're going to live and what we're going to experience? Well, where do we get the information from? Well, we get the information from our own brain. We are talking to ourselves like these people are talking to themselves. Now, can you imagine that this young man in college had a brain a little larger than normal, but not too far out, and nobody recognized that there was nothing in his head, just fluid, and just a slim shell of brain inside his skull. And the doctors made the check and found, and he lived a normal, healthy life, and doing many things. He was not a great athlete or something like that, because he would need to have the control of his head. He'd need to have his brain and so forth physically to hold into place so that he wouldn't hurt himself that way. But he did very well. Here you and I, as far as I know, each have a normal head and a normal brain and normal activities, and what are we doing with it? We are saying to ourselves that we don't know. We are saying to ourselves that we can't do. And so therefore, that's what we're doing. Now, as we are spiritually illumined, we say to ourselves, well, now let's forget that. We can say of ourselves that we are spiritually illumined. If we say to ourselves that we are spiritually illumined, what does that mean to us? What does it mean to be spiritually illumined? Does it mean that you are living in that high state of awareness of your divinity? Is that what it means? Or does it mean that you would like to live in that high state of consciousness? Well, the fact is that we do live in that high state of consciousness. It's just that we have not yet claimed it and made it ours. And we claim it by saying our special word that each of us have chosen and saying, I am peace, I am illumination, I am balance, I am whatever you want to say for yourself. And when you make that statement, make it and make it and make it. Don't plead with it. Don't expect that you're going to make it happen. You are just changing your mind from the thought that you cannot do it to the realization that it's already done. And now you're just revealing it to your experience, and it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice. You're revealing to yourself that you're fantastic, that you're glorious, that you're wonderful, that you are a genius, that you are a magic person, that you can live an infinite number of years. Most people say they don't want to live a long life, because they don't want to live in an unhealthy body. Well, why don't you say, I live a long life in my healthy body. I live eternally in my healthy body. And when I no longer choose to be on this planet Earth, and I give up my body, I'll be giving up a healthy body. And I'll be moving into an awareness of my other levels of consciousness, and that's just great. But it's a healthy body that belongs to me because I have a healthy mind. It is a healthy experience that I belong to because I have a healthy mind that creates healthy experiences. Anything I want, I create by my thought. And I create a healthy experience by my healthy mind, by my healthy words. And that's why I say, I am peace. I am illumination. I am the allness. I am that I am. And it's not a matter that you am. It's just a matter of peace. It's just a matter of illumination. It's just a matter of balance. When these are your clarion words, they're your call into the infinite, your claim upon the truth of your nature, then that is what you experience. And if this appeals to you, if this delights you, if this amuses, amazes, and excites you, then go for it. Go for it. Christina, you want to be a ballet dancer. Well, you can't. Because you've got two left feet, you know? And your brain doesn't even understand what music is all about. And you are not an attractive-looking woman. You are a very gluck woman. And Christina says, I am a beautiful woman. My feet are perfect. I am a very attractive woman. I love music. I understand it. And I am a fabulous ballet dancer. And that's the words. And so, within a snap, or longer, depending upon how much she has to overcome in her consciousness, she will be a ballet dancer. And she will be a very good one, because she has given her whole heart and soul to it, to demonstrating what the outward appearance would seem to deny. She is putting a cause in motion of being a ballet dancer. Now, what kind of ballet do you like, Christina? And she doesn't know right at the moment, but what kind of ballet do you like? What kind of place do you want to play? You want to be in the chorus, or do you want to be the ballerina? Do you want to be the cheese, you know? Do you want to be the person who excites the audience, and they say, wow, what a glorious woman, what a glorious body. Now, Christina, this is not to defend the situation, but you have probably not done this research, but mentally join me. We're now going to the ballet, and we're going to look at the women up on stage. Now, the prettiest woman isn't the greatest dancer. The greatest dancer is magical, but she's not the most beautiful. She is made up very attractively. She has all of the makeup that embellishes her possibilities, but the lighting and everything else and the magic of her dancing, you don't even see her face. So you don't have to physically look beautiful. You have to look beautiful at what you're doing. And so then her body is a little short, a little bit stubby, a little bit this and that, but her movements are so pure grace. Her movements are so pure beauty and harmony with the movement of the music, you don't even see what her body is. You only see this beautiful being as a great dancer. Why is it that men who are dancing ballet usually have to be reasonably tall? Because many times the ballerina is tall. And many times the ballerina is an odd size. And he has to compensate for that with his appearance. But there are some jerks, some guys who just didn't get the message, and they're shorties, and they are exquisite ballet dancers. They're exquisite. Their movements are just pure magic and music, and nobody even notices that they're not tall. Nobody even notices that the ballerina looks down at them and smiles. They don't even see that, because the magic of the soul expressing in the joy of the movement overwhelms any other possibility of distraction. Now, you are not an unattractive woman. You are not an ungainly body. You've got everything going for you. So if you do choose to be a ballerina, you can do it without too much effort, because you've got everything going for you. But now, Christina, what do you want to do? Do you want to see without your eyes? Do you want to reach an old age? Do you want to to work in a company? Do you want to, what do you want to do? You see, you don't know yet. But the day will come when you set the course for what you'd like to do, and then you'll go for it. Now, you can do that, but are you ready to do that? Are you ready to make that decision? Are you ready to see who you are and what magic you are, you know? When you are, then you'll have it. But most people have not made up their mind as to where their magic lay, you know? Most people have no idea where their where their real love is. Oh, the first thing is money, you know, always money. And what is it? Yes, Rhonda is allowed by her son to marry if the man has money, you know. Now, really, her son did not mean that. He said, "Mom, if this man is gentle, sensitive, tender, caring, and a very fabulous man, that's all that's needed. He doesn't have to have a penny, we'll take care of him. But because we are good creators, we create him abundant in every way. We create him wealthy in every way. But that's not the key. That's just natural to come with the perfect man, right? That's just natural to come with the perfect man." So, you see, get rid of the idea of money, because money oftentimes hides a lot of things. Women who have money and marry a man, they lord it over the man, so he loses all of his masculinity, he loses all of his feeling of contribution to the family, and she can outdo me 100 times over, you know. For men to marry Liz Taylor type people, you know, they have to be spectacular men, really spectacular men. And that the marriages don't last very long is understandable, because it's my money, says the person involved, you know. And when people say it's my money, my goodness, you know, what sense of personal success or self-confidence does the other person have? It's difficult. But again, we're not dwelling in that area. We're dwelling in the area of the magic of the mind, the magic of the soul, the amazement of who we are and how we can reveal that and experience that and enjoy that. You can. Because when you speak your word that we each chose for ourselves now, and we didn't say, "I am illumined, I am illumination, I am peace, I am balance, I am oneness." We said peace, balance, oneness. And you see, the moment you drop all of the extra material around the concept stands as a pure idea and can be manifest as a pure idea without limitation. And manifesting as a pure idea without limitation, you can accomplish any joy of your heart. Any joy. Now, if you want to accomplish these joys of your heart, then go for it. If you don't, then go on saying, "I can't do this, I can't do that, I'm stupid, you know, and I'm just marrying men for their money, and I'm just doing this, and I," you know, go on saying these things. Now, you say, "Well, Herb, I revealed that to you in secret, and that wasn't to be used as public knowledge." No, it wasn't. And I didn't say who it was who said it, did I? But everybody knows. And Rhonda doesn't care that I didn't say that with her name. You know, Rhonda didn't even care at all that I mentioned that at all. She didn't care. You know, the telephone rang as I was working at my desk, and I picked up the phone in a gruff voice, and I said, "Yes?" And the person timidly answered the phone and said, "Hello." And I said, "Who is it? May I help you?" And she says, "This is Dee Dee." And I said, "Who's Dee Dee?" And she says, "Oh, this is Dee Dee. I met you all over at the church in the Wildwood." I said, "Oh, yeah, I remember your name. Dee Dee Felix, isn't it?" "Yeah, yeah." She says, "Yeah." And I said, "What can I do for you?" She said, "Well, I'd like you to change my address. I moved. And I'd like to continue receiving the gist." And she says, "You're having a seminar right now, aren't you?" "Yep." She says, "Oh, I'd love to attend it." And I said, well, we can make arrangements for you to attend. I'll have Ellen call you so that you know the next time we're having a seminar or whatever Ellen chooses to do. And we'll take care of that. And then she said she had a problem. And the problem was that she was moving, and she was moving because the fire was coming close and they had to abandon their houses. And so she was moving, and then this was the second move she had to make. And a lady friend of hers was upset with her because she was so stupid as to lock the keys in her car. And she couldn't get in her car and move it under these very terrible circumstances. But she finally did. And her friend said, I don't want you as a friend anymore. You are just too stupid. You know? And I thought to myself, how lovely, you know, how really lovely. And I said to Didi, I said, you know, sometimes people get very emotional and they are so panicky that when they grab the child from in front of the car and save its life, they take their hand and beat the hell out of it, you know, and because they're frustrated, they're so concerned, and they just don't have judgment. And but they did save the child, and that's a big measure. But the child all his life said, I wonder why Mama spanked me when she pulled me out of, you know, and she told me how it happened, she told me what I did. And so all the kid's life, he's got that in his heart. Well, we'll have to work with her to release this attitude from her mind. Now, you see, we have great potential. We have great potential. And then I got another telephone call. And the telephone call said that I was an incompetent nincompoop. Uh-huh. A total incompetent nincompoop. It says, I am calling to remind you that I'll be calling at 7:15 tonight, and be sure to be there, as though I wasn't going to be there, you know? And I probably won't. But the thing is, how utterly outrageous to think that I don't remember, that I don't recall. Now, you see, when a person does that, they're indicating their own insecurities. They're indicating their own unhappiness, their own misunderstanding. And he has come to the end of a rope, and he will be hanging from it shortly, but it'll be his choice. And we never associate ourselves with people who do not believe in us. We never associate with people who do not trust us, who do not have confidence in us. We have confidence in ourselves, and it's hard enough for us to build our own confidence in ourselves. And to have people in our world who don't have confidence in us. Now, why wouldn't he believe that we would have been waiting for him and his telephone call? Because he knew he was doing something wrong. And you see, when you do something wrong, you cut yourself off from everything. When you do not speak your word saying, I am peace, I am love, I am harmony, I am abundance, when you do not realize when you create people in your world who are beautiful, and instead of doubting them, you should be praising them and saying, it'll be so nice to talk to you, it'll be so nice to be sharing with you, or whatever the thing may be. But that's over now too. So these are things that we have to be strong about, because our heart says, reach out to somebody who has problems. And the law says, have nothing to do with them. Speak only to them, you are whole and perfect. You are wonderful, you are good. But let them alone. Let them alone. If someone does not want to walk in the pure light, your shining the pure light on them will not help them. You can shine it only on yourself and see them walking in their own pure light. Now, this is what we all must learn to do. And I might sound vindictive and so forth by these statements, but it's not meant to be that way at all. It's merely meant to be a waking up call for me. Because you see, I am dishonest. I have told this person You may call once a week, and any call you make is going to be a registered call. That is, I will consider it a call. Whether it is a call on my answering service, or whether it is a call in fact. And it will be considered a call. And so, this person has made 12 calls since that remark was made this past week. And so, it just has to cease. It just has to cease. Because he does not respect himself, and he certainly does not respect us by the calls. So, what I'm saying by all of these things to you is that if you are going to go around saying, I am whole and perfect, and then go around and say, I hurt, my foot hurts, my tummy hurts, my this hurts, then you're violating yourself. You cannot go around and say to someone, you may call once a week, and that's all, and then accept other calls from them because you are violating your program and your rules. And we have to be very careful that we don't do that. I don't really care. I don't really care. I bless these people, I love these people, but I don't really care. Because all I do care about is that they are living according to their light, and I see them living according to the bright harmony of peace within them. Now, I have said to each of us, do not accept certain calls. And we have each accepted these calls because we thought perhaps they were important. We thought perhaps it was very necessary, but it wasn't. And so, therefore, we each helped to cause this person to violate the rule. We each helped it. We in the School of the Master are taught that we are the only people. I'm number one. We're the only people. And in the School of the Master, we're taught that when we go through the door, we should close it. And that when we are going through the door, we just go zip. With it. Even if there is someone behind us, because there's nobody behind us. Because we are alone there. You understand? And to say that you're alone and have ghosts behind you, so to speak, real people, but it's hard. It's hard. So, what you do, you gently do everything you do. You gently do it. And you slam the door right in front of somebody else's face, so to speak, because they're not there. And the person knows that you're not up in front of them. So they're not going to rush through a door that appears to be open. They're going to know that they must open that door and they must close that door. So if the door is open, they wait a moment because the wind apparently has opened it or something like that, you know. Or maybe there's an electronic door that's opening it. But you wait, and then you open it yourself. But if you cannot live with the consciousness that you are the only person in the universe, that you're number one, then you will have these experiences of people coming into your world and not following what you believe and what you teach and what you share and what you are. You know, it's one thing to ask for praise. It's another thing to give praise, but it's still another thing to live what you have agreed to do. And to me, when people come and give us a donation, and then they say, oh yeah, I'd like the gist too. Put the gist on that donation. And we say, just a minute. Here is your donation. You give us the $30 for the gist, and then you give us whatever you want to give us, which is like $2 is a donation, you know. And this is what you have done. The gist is $30 for mailing, or $20, or whatever price it is. And so, you see, I say no, I don't do that. When you give a gift, it's a gift. And if you want to allocate that gift, it's not a gift. You understand? When you pay your subscription to a magazine, that's not a gift. But if you pay your subscription to the magazine and send them an extra $1,000 and say, I appreciate your editorial policies and this is to go along with your publication, you know, that's a gift. So we have to be very careful of these things because a lot of times we feel that money that we give is ours to delegate, and it's not. If you delegate it at the moment you give it, then that's fine. That's fine. You're perfectly welcome to do that, but not afterwards. And so it is when you give help or guidance or anything to anybody. You give it out of total love and out of total appreciation and delight, and then everything is in order. And what Didi wants to know too is how much the seminar costs. And so that's something you have to determine. You have not determined it this time. And we're working on these things. We're coming to conclusions on these things. We're understanding these things. But I'm giving you these mundane expressions, these mundane illustrations, because they're very real. They're very real. Now, why did I create that happening in my world? Because I used it as an illustration with you guys. Do you think it bothers me that this person does that? No. I would like to see him handle things differently, but it doesn't bother me. I just love him and see him doing his own thing, as I love each one of you and see you doing your own thing. And that's a wonderful thing, because each one of you are supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Each one of you are magnificent. Each one of you are honorable. Each one of you, if you choose to be ballerina, you can do it, because you will give all the energy necessary to it. If you choose to be peace, you will give all the energy necessary to it. Energy to peace? That's right. Because that means every thought you have is a peace thought. Every action you take is a peace action. Every thing that you think, say, or do in any way is peace. And you are incapable of unpeaceful attitudes. What do the Swiss do? Are they a peaceful nation?
Yes.
Why are they a peaceful nation?
Because they have their cause put into motion.
Ellen, you don't know why they're a peaceful nation, so you just say they're a peaceful nation because they're a peaceful nation. You see, the simpler the answer, the more true it is. But they're a peaceful nation because they're a peaceful nation. Why is some nation a warring nation?
Everybody is a peaceful nation.
There are no warring nations. There are only warring nations to people who think war. And if you think war, even the peaceful nations are at war as far as you're concerned. If you think war, you will see the Swiss government at war because it has its internal military organization, because it has its discipline that they have and stuff like that. You know, if you want to see war, you'll see it anywhere you want, even though it does not exist. You will create it, and you will enjoy it. Are you ready to be the master of yourself? Then you take your word now. You have 3 hours before supper to take that word. You'll go into the gymnasium and first you'll have your meditation. I am spiritually illumined for an hour. And then you'll have your gymnasium work, and then you'll have the preparation for dinner. So you got 3 hours in which to say every instant, whatever your statement is, illumined, peace, balanced, whatever statement you've chosen for yourself, that you are right now. And no matter what you're doing, that is on the tip of your mind. If you're on the chai machine in here wiggling away, you say peace, 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 illumination, 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 and you'd just be wiggling to illumination. But don't let yourself skip it. It's too important. By the time this week is over, I expect each one of you to be saying it in your sleep.
Yes.
And I expect each one of you to be living it totally in your total being. Because you're all masters, and you're all fabulous, and you're all great, and you're all right. And I love you very much. Now, tomorrow morning, we're going to have our first lecture at 9, entitled, Is Everyone Interested? And that should give us a little something to think about. I love you, and have a lovely afternoon.
Thank you.